Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles that were published in March of 2026 from the online edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. The April hard copy has not arrived yet. I'll begin with this article. A new book of Toni Morrison's university lectures, now collected for the first time, shares some of the legendary novelist's most important lessons. At Princeton, the author analyzed the depictions of blackness in the works of canonical American authors. It's by Kunja Bastola, an editorial intern. Before her career as a novelist, Toni Morrison was a teacher. The famed American author, best known for works such as Beloved and Song of Solomon, was born in Lorain, Ohio in 1931. After attending Howard University to study English and Cornell University for graduate school, she returned to Howard in 1957 to teach English. She then joined a writers' group and developed a short story, which would become The Bluest Eye, 1970, her first acclaimed novel. Morrison was often making history. In the 1960s, she became the first black woman to be an editor at the publisher Random House. In 1988, Morrison won the Pulitzer Prize for Beloved, and in 1993, she became the first black woman to win the Nobel Prize for her contributions to writing and publishing. She died in 2019 at 88. Through her novels, essay collections, children's books, speeches, interviews, and a feature-length documentary, her literary legacy lives on. This year, several Ohio literary groups led the launch of a statewide year-long celebration of Morrison's life and work. She emboldened other writers to center the African-American experience and explore rare, sometimes shocking themes such as incest, insanity, and colorism, says Deborah Tilani Salahu-Din, curator of language and literature at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, in an email. Through all these mechanisms, Morrison exerted influence in the literary sphere and broadened the American literary canon. In 1989, Morrison began teaching literature, creative writing, and African American studies at Princeton University. For the first time, a series of her Princeton lectures has been compiled into a book, Language as Liberation, Reflections on the American Canon. Published last month, nearly 7 years after her death, the new collection explores race in mainstream American literature. Now readers can engage with Morrison not only through the lens of her fiction or essays, but through her role as a teacher. Ford Morrison, the author's son, helped compile the lectures, which came from a course she taught titled Studies in American Africanism, and wrote the foreword for the book. She asked her students to meet the writing where it lived, without shortcuts, without softening. The same intensity threads through every page here, he writes. Carolyn Denard, a scholar and educator of Morrison's literary works and the founder of the Toni Morrison Society, says that Morrison was a keen observer of the lives of black people in the United States, particularly the ways in which African Americans were depicted in literature by white American writers. Her observations are part of this new book, as Morrison examines work such as Sapphira and the Slave Girl by Willa Cather, Lie Down in Darkness by William Stryon, and Absalon, Absalon, by William Faulkner. Claudia Brodsky, a comparative literature scholar at Princeton University and friend and colleague of Morrison, wrote the introduction to Language as Liberation. While working on the project, Brodsky says she gained a deeper understanding of how Morrison challenged the thinking about the depictions of Black people in literature, and how those ideas have framed society's collective consciousness over time. Morrison observed the difficulty that white American writers had with portraying Black characters, Denard says. She adds that these authors often don't really know what to do with these characters because they don't know how to penetrate beyond the kind of surface, representational, often stereotypical presentation of these characters. In one of her lectures, Morrison discusses Cather, a writer best known for her books about life in the Great Plains, such as O Pioneers and My Antonia. Cather's last novel, Sapphira and the Slave Girl, 1940, is a story of a bitter white woman named Sapphira who struggles with edema. Sapphira believes her husband is having a relationship with an enslaved teenager named Nancy and becomes irrationally jealous and abusive toward her. Sapphira's daughter, an abolitionist who is not close with her mother, enlists her father's aid to help Nancy escape to freedom. In some ways, this novel is a classic fugitive slave narrative, the thrilling escape of the bound into freedom, except that we learn practically nothing of the trials of the fugitive's journey, because the emphasis is on Nancy's fugitive state within the household before her escape. Except that the real fugitive, the text asserts, is the slave mistress. Except that the plot itself is a fugitive from the author, says Morrison in her lecture on Cather. Brodsky says she believes Morrison's messages are much needed. There is no better time to read a book of Toni Morrison's lectures on American literature than now, Brodsky says. Some of Morrison's own works, The Bluest Eye and Beloved, have been banned in school districts across the country. Salahuddin notes that Morrison faced heightened obstacles as a Black writer wanting to write about Black people compared to some of the white canonical authors she discusses in the lectures. She challenged any criticism that suggested writers of African descent should cease writing so much from this inherent space that reflects both their rich and complex life experiences and creative imaginations, Salahuddin says. She pointed out that such expectation is never levied at writers of non-African descent. Mark Twain, for example, writes without challenge from the gut of his Missouri experience, and William Faulkner, about whom Morrison wrote her master's thesis, can quietly pen novels fueled by the depths of his Mississippi reality. The work that is perhaps most relevant in understanding language as liberation is Morrison's 1992 literary critique, Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and the Literary Imagination, in which she analyzes the way white American authors foster perceptions of Blackness that define not only their works, but the American literary canon. While the audience for Playing in the Dark was mostly scholars, Denard explains that Language as Liberation offers the public a guide in Morrison who sheds a light on what is hidden in plain view. This book grew from the belief that my mother's teaching materials, her lectures, essays, and notes to students deserve to stand with her published work, writes Ford Morrison. They were written for the classroom, where she believed the glorious world of thinking and teaching happened in real time, and where language could still Surprise. And that completes the article. The author, Kunjal Bastola, is an editorial intern with Smithsonian Magazine. And the title of her article, A New Book of Toni Morrison's University Lectures, now collected for the first time, shares some of the legendary novelist's most important lessons. The next article is titled Alien Life Could Look Nothing Like What We Expect. Here's how microbes beyond Earth might live without liquid water. Like the lead character of Project Hail Mary, some scientists are proposing ways that life might exist beyond a star's habitable zone, often considered the gold standard of potential livability. It's written by Mackenzie Prilliman, an assistant digital editor, Science and Innovation. Every known living thing on Earth needs water. The life-giving liquid makes up around 60% of each human's body weight, regulating temperature, transporting nutrients to cells, and protecting organs. Plants need it to make their own food, and fungi use it to break down organic matter. Water is so crucial that the search for life, particularly beyond our solar system, often homes in on a specific region around a star known as its habitable zone. That's the space where a rocky planet, moon, or other body orbits at just the right distance so that its temperature and other factors might allow water, liquid water, to pool on its surface. But it's possible to imagine worlds that support life in other ways. In the science fiction novel Project Hail Mary, released as a film adaptation in theaters today, the main character, Rylan Grace, criticizes the idea of the habitable zone and suspects that liquid water is not necessary for life beyond Earth. That proposal, deemed ridiculous by his colleagues, gets him laughed out of academia. Recent research, however, suggests that his idea might not be so out there after all, at least when it comes to water on a planet or moon's surface. In our solar system, Saturn's chilly moon, Enceladus, and Jupiter's Europa are top contenders for possibly hosting microbes, despite sitting outside the sweet spot for livability and having icy crusts. Some real-life scientists are now proposing unusual ways in which alien microbes might persist without what we've long considered to be a vital fluid. Their work indicates that life might be able to survive in seemingly inhospitable settings. What is the requirement for life? We don't know. We only have one example, says Nok Truong, a planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. We have to broaden our perspective on ways that life can survive. Earth formed about 4.5 billion years ago, and the earliest clear signs of life, such as fossilized microbes, date to about 1 billion years later. Most scientists suspect that the organisms that gave rise to all of the planet's life today emerged in water, but they're not sure what initially sparked these beings' formation. Some think that the building blocks of proteins and genetic code, or even microbes themselves, arrived on Earth via comets and asteroids that pelted the young planet, while others say lightning or solar radiation may have kick-started the production of complex organic compounds. Another popular idea is that life was born on the seafloor, around hydrothermal vents, which contain hot, churning, nutrient-filled fluids that mix with ocean water. Regardless of the exact origin story, If the life-fueling chemistry got started in water, that convenient matchup may have led to earthly organisms' reliance on water, says Zach Adam, a prebiotic chemist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Powering cells requires lots of chemical reactions, which typically need a fluid to facilitate them. Luckily, water often fits the bill, largely because it can dissolve more substances than most other liquids can, earning it the nickname the universal solvent. Further, water makes sense as a possible facilitator of life across the cosmos, because it's somewhat common within our Milky Way galaxy, says Peter Grigius, a marine microbiologist at Harvard. It's all over the place. That's why astronomers looking for life beyond the solar system have set their sights on the habitable zone. Although the term didn't gain popularity until the 1970s, the concept can be traced to Isaac Newton, who wrote in the 17th century that Earth's life-giving surface water would exist only at a certain distance from the sun. It would be frozen if we were at Saturn's position in our solar system and vaporized at Mercury's. Across planetary systems, the habitable zone's location varies depending on the star's mass, age, and temperature. Simply being in this special region doesn't mean that a world can support life. One planetary candidate reported last year, for example, orbits within the habitable zone of the star Alpha Centauri A, but it's probably an inhospitable gas giant. A rocky world in a star's habitable zone could trap too much heat if it has lots of greenhouse gases in its atmosphere, making its surface too hot for water to remain in liquid form. Outside the habitable zone, worlds that lack surface water could still have the liquid somewhere underground. For instance, scientists are looking for signs of life on the moons Enceladus and Europa because spacecraft flybys suggest that they contain subsurface oceans, as well as certain chemical compounds that could lead to microbes. Something like earthly life might be able to survive there, but other worlds with vastly disparate conditions might host life forms that operate unlike anything we've encountered. Frozen microbes might be powered by radiation. Picture a frigid, rocky planet covered in ice. Its surface water is frozen because it's extremely far from its star. Unlike Earth, this world doesn't have an atmosphere or a global magnetic field shielding it from incoming radiation. High-energy particles called galactic cosmic rays, which constantly permeate through space and come primarily from supernovas, therefore bombard its surface and penetrate the ice. Those cosmic rays might spark a chemical reaction in the ice called radiolysis, and its products could theoretically sustain dormant microbes underground. In a study published this past July in the International Journal of Astrobiology, researchers calculated how much life could be supported by that process. When you just go below the surface, then this radiation is actually creating so many chemical reactions, says study co-author Demetra Atri, an astrobiologist at New York University, Abu Dhabi, in the United Arab Emirates. It produces stable molecules, and many of these stable molecules, such as amino acids, they are useful for life. Radiolysis also generates hydrogen, which can serve as microbe food on Earth, and negatively charged electrons, which are needed for practically all known chemical reactions, including those that create life's energy currency, he says. Attree and his colleagues estimated how many electrons could be induced by cosmic ray radiolysis on a few worlds in our solar system. They determined that Enceladus has the best potential for sustaining hypothetical microbes this way. According to their calculations, the reaction could support more than 700,000 bacterial cells per cubic inch of ice, around 6.5 feet below the surface there. Although incoming radiation would be harmful atop the ice, hypothetical microbes underground would be protected from the worst of it, Attree notes, and they might even have developed defenses against the damaging rays, just as many living things on Earth have adapted to withstand low-energy radiation from the sun by producing melanin, or tanning, for example. Radiolysis-powered life on frigid worlds isn't that far-fetched. The earthly bacterium Candidatus disulfurarudus ada ex viator can dwell almost 2 miles underground, sustained by radiolysis induced by the decay of radioactive elements. And microorganisms called psychrophiles thrive in the chilliest corners of our home planet, thanks to adaptations like proteins that prevent ice crystallization in their cells. Because of this, the researchers suggest expanding the search for life to what they call the radiolytic habitable zone, where cosmic rays could reach underground ice or water. This might even include certain rogue planets that don't have a host star, Attree says. Those that aren't too cold for life-sustaining chemical reactions, such as worlds with relatively warm spots heated by decaying radioactive substances, might be able to maintain dormant life via radiolysis. Still, going from hosting dormant life to supporting a thriving ecosystem would probably require some kind of liquid, Attree notes. A world's life-giving liquid might not be water, however. On some rocky planets, theoretical beings might instead rely on liquefied salts, according to a study published this past August in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. These special salts melt into liquids in conditions below 212 degrees Fahrenheit. Formerly called ionic liquids, they've been studied for decades in industry, including in drug development, says study co-author Sarah Seeger, an astrophysicist at MIT. Previous research has used ionic liquids to carry out chemical reactions with various building blocks of life, she adds. Within them are dozens of proteins that are stable. Most known ionic liquids are human-made, but Seeger and her colleagues stumbled upon some that might exist naturally on other worlds. While attempting to reproduce the conditions of Venus in the lab, one researcher noticed that trying to evaporate sulfuric acid out of the makeshift atmosphere always left behind a bit of odd liquid. The team realized that the sulfuric acid was reacting with glycine, an amino acid, or a building block of proteins that had been detected in Venus's atmosphere. In chemical reactions, sulfuric acid wants to donate a positively charged proton, so it will react with molecules that want to receive a proton, Seeger says. Nitrogen-containing organic molecules, including amino acids and the bases of genetic code, fit that description. So the researchers tested more than 30 types of nitrogen-containing organics to see whether they could create ionic liquids by interacting with sulfuric acid across several temperatures and atmospheric pressures. Most did, even atop basalt, one of the most common rocks on the surfaces of other planets, showing that the fluids might be widespread. The experiments hint that rocky whorls, lacking liquid water on their surfaces, because they are either too hot or have atmospheres too thin to keep it there, could theoretically support life that relies on ionic liquids. Such a place would probably require a tiny bit of underground water and volcanic activity to supply sulfuric acid for the reaction, Seeger says. And it would need to have no water in the air because ionic liquids love water and easily absorb it, which might change their properties, she adds. Of course, nitrogen-containing organics would also need to be present, but luckily organics seem common among solid surfaced whorls, at least where we've searched for them within the solar system. What's more, it might not take much of these solvents to spawn life, because ionic liquids don't easily evaporate. Even tiny puddles might make significant, sufficient habitats for theoretical microscopic beings. And with that, we have run out of time today. The name of this article was Alien Life Could Look Nothing Like What We Expect. Here's how microbes beyond Earth might live without liquid water, by Mackenzie Prilliman, an assistant digital editor. You've been listening to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program today. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.